you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us on this Monday. We're going to begin by opening up the phones for listeners to weigh in on whether you think cities should take positions on international issues. This, of course, became huge during the time of apartheid in South Africa, when many state and local governing bodies took stances in support of a boycott against the then South African government over its apartheid policies. And that was something that we saw that was nowhere near as controversial as what's being called for right now with Israel's military action in Gaza. The city of Pasadena, just the latest to be dealing with this. And in fact, the Pasadena City Council has moved its meeting late this afternoon, its regular Monday meeting, to the Pasadena Convention Center so that they would have a room large enough for the large crowd expected late this afternoon for the council meeting where the issue will be taken up. Whether the city should, among a number of questions it's looking at, pass a resolution or consider a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. A group of rabbis in Pasadena and the executive director of the Jewish Federation of the San Gabriel and Pomona Valleys had a meeting with a number of city officials, according to a statement released by the group late last week. And the rabbis say that passing a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza would open up Jews in the Pasadena area to increasing anti-Semitism, and that that would be harmful, and that just calling for a ceasefire, according to the rabbis who were part of this effort, also doesn't speak to the issue of Hamas provocation in the attack last October. I want to hear from you very generally, because this is an issue that has come up on a number of occasions. Do you think it is appropriate for cities to weigh in on international issues? Obviously, in this case, there is a very close relationship between the U.S. and Israel. So this is one where it's not a huge distance between U.S. policy and what's happening in Gaza, as you might find where the United States is a far less connected body in that action. However, here, the intent of activists who are trying to get cities like Pasadena to pass pro-ceasefire ordinances is to try and put pressure on the Biden administration to pressure Israel more strongly to have to agree to a ceasefire in Gaza and to halt its military actions there. So I'd like to hear from you what you think. And this really isn't so much about, do you think that Pasadena or other cities, some cities have already passed such a measure, such a resolution. It's not whether you think Pasadena should do this or not. That's kind of binary, not really as interesting. It's whether you think cities should do this and if they should be open to passing resolutions on international issues. What do you think the criteria should be? What is a case where a city, it makes sense for them to weigh in on an issue and where not? We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and first name. You can also share your thoughts about whether cities should take up resolutions on international issues on our AirTalk page at laist.com/airtalk. That's laist.com/airtalk to weigh in on this. They're expecting in Pasadena late this afternoon to have hundreds of people showing up at the convention center for this meeting to take it on. And interestingly, in some of these other cities, it's my understanding, the meetings have largely been attended by activists calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. not so much by those who are opposed to that. But here in Pasadena, we have the rabbis at Chabad of Pasadena and Jason Moss, the executive director of the Jewish Federation of the San Gabriel and Pomona Valleys, meeting with city officials and urging them not to pass a resolution. They've also said if the city is going to pass a resolution, it shouldn't be just about Israel's military action in Gaza. It should be about Hamas's releasing of the Israeli hostages and Hamas surrendering, that should be part of the call if there is going to be a call for a ceasefire in Gaza. So should cities do this? Is it in their best interest to do it? Can they represent their constituents' views? I think one of the real challenges with highly contentious issues, as the ceasefire in Gaza is, how do you represent the range of views within a council member's particular district? Because on such a polarizing issue as the war in Gaza, and what the policy should be, and what the Biden administration should be pursuing, that is a very fraught issue for elected officials to take on in their districts. How do you represent your constituents when you're going to have a range of opinions among those people that brought you to office? 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Janice in Altadena says, I think it's fine for local communities to make a statement, but I'm unsure it has any effect. Better to use the energy on federal legislation or funding issues where it could actually matter. 866-893-5722. Daniel in West Covina, good to have you with us. Do you think cities should take on international issues?
I think they should. I mean, I think they provide a healthy, structured outlet. I mean, we're not always going to agree on the tactic. I mean, people complain that people shouldn't be protesting in the streets or blocking bridges. And I think this provides a structured forum for people to voice their concerns and opinions, you know?
When you've got competing opinions, though, on something like what's happening in Gaza, how do elected officials, Daniel, effectively represent that division of opinion?
Well, I think that they provide a space for everybody to be able to share their comments and speak up, I mean, during those comment sessions and so forth. And then I think the public officials will be held accountable at the end of the election time, you know, if indeed they make the wrong decision or don't represent their community.
All right. I appreciate it. Daniel in West Covina, starting us off, 866-893-5722. We have Omri in Beverly Hills. Omri, what do you think?
I think it's kind of a waste of time. It's a waste of words. It's just empty virtue signaling for a city to say their opinion on international issues, because what can a city really do? They can just publish a letter, post a tweet, you know, maybe do a news segment, but nothing happens. Nothing changes with that.
I think that my guess is, not to speak for the activists who are calling for the ceasefire resolution, but my assumption is their feeling is if they get enough cities with Democratic majorities like Pasadena and their city councils across the United States calling for a ceasefire, that exerts some degree of political pressure on the Biden administration, particularly during the presidential election, that it kind of forces the president to pay attention to that. Do you think that would be likely to happen if you got a high percentage of Democratic majority cities to do this?
I think if there are, you know, enough cities, so maybe it could all add up to put some pressure on the administration. But even still, you know, they have professionals, they have experts, they have, you know, plenty of bureaucrats who do this for a living, who speak to all of the foreign ministers on both sides, and these people, we have to trust that they know what they're doing, that you know that what they're doing is really in the best interest of the country.
All right. I appreciate it, Omri. Thank you very much. That's Omri in Beverly Hills. Ann in Silver Lake said, it's not just an international issue. It's really national because our tax dollars are being used to support international conflicts. And that's absolutely right that it is a domestic issue as well because of the funding portion of it and also the support even beyond just funding that Israel is provided by the United States. And that's what I was saying earlier about this is a closer issue than you might see in some other international issues. Terry in Pasadena says, I'm Jewish. I'm from a family of Holocaust survivors. I think our collective voice is needed to share our opinions on international issues. I think it does put pressure on governments and our local politicians. Local governments have power. That's Terry in Pasadena. And Ron in downtown LA says, I think local cities should take stances on international issues. They don't need to do it with everyone, but in this case, it's important. It provides an indicator of what people want. That's Ron in downtown Los Angeles. Thank you so much for your comments. Again, the Pasadena City Council meeting is late this afternoon at the Pasadena Convention Center, a larger hall because of the expected crowd calling for and in opposition to a ceasefire in Gaza.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. And of course, not all of the races are decided in the California election. Tomorrow we'll be bringing you the very latest on where those still contested races stand. But I want to turn our attention now to the topic of a recent column by Los Angeles Times political columnist Mark Baraback about the ongoing Southern versus Northern California political power question. As you probably know, if you've been covering, or I should say been interested in California politics for some years, you know that relative to its population, the North has had outsized political power. We're joined by Mark, in addition to Loyola Marymount University professor Fernando Guerra. Mark, let me start with you. So what does the U.S. Senate race say about the North-South axis in California?
Well, I think what it signals is a fundamental shift in that power. I have to digress for a second. I want to give a shout-out to Tom Hanks. You mentioned in the last pledge break, my fellow Skyline High School grad.
Hey, very good.
So going back to your question, you know, I did a column just about a year ago when Adam Schiff and Katie Porter showed up here in the Bay Area at Rossmore. It's a 55 and older community. They claimed to have one of the largest Democratic clubs in the country. And they drew between them. They both drew hundreds of guests. Schiff, about 500 people showed up. Katie Porter, about 400 people, which certainly is really remarkable and speaks to that shift that I'm talking about. I mean, I've covered California politics for a long time, and I can tell you that most House members can hardly draw flies outside their own district. And the idea that they were drawing hundreds of people a year out struck me as rather remarkable. So I went and I looked after this after last week's primary and found that, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, time flies, and found that Adam Schiff had won all nine Bay Area counties, which again, is really remarkable. For a guy whose district lays 300 miles away, to sweep all nine Bay Area counties, to me, suggests a really, really important shift in California and its politics. And the bottom line to me is it's gone from being geography to celebrity. Celebrity is what matters these days.
Well, I wonder, too, just about the presentational skills as well. Adam Schiff is a very polished speaker. He's been on so many television news programs over the years. He's really honed his speaking skills. And of course, he developed a much higher profile leading the first House impeachment effort against former President Trump, but even before that. And Katie Porter with her whiteboard and being a college professor, she is gifted as a speaker as well. So you had two rhetorical powerhouses, I would argue, in Southern California, comparatively. So I wonder how much of this, Mark, is really regional versus the specifics of the candidates involved.
Skills that you talk about help, but people got to be interested in what you have to say. People have to turn out. People have to tune in. People have to be attuned to what you're saying and be interested before you can demonstrate those skills. And as you suggest, Adam Schiff and Katie Porter both became what, you know, in the realm of politics are celebrities, household names through Katie Whiteford's presentation, as you suggest, Adam Schiff through impeachment. He also had the benefit of being censured by House Republicans. So, you know, again, these are folks who are well known in ways that, you know, in that column I mentioned I did a year ago, I talked to Rose Kapuscinski. She ran Barbara Boxer's campaign back in 1992 when she ran for Senate and pulled off an upset winning, you know, a Bay Area candidate winning. She said the idea that we could have shown up and say Laguna Niguel a year before the election to draw 500 people is just fantastical. It just shows, again, how social media, how TV, how the celebrification of politicians through cable TV, through news, through social media has changed the political equation here in California.
We're talking with LA Times political columnist and multi-time guest with us on Air Talk over the years, Mark Baraback, also with us from Loyola Marymount University and the Center for the Study of Los Angeles, professor of political science and Chicano, Chicana, Latino, Latina studies, Fernando Guerra. Professor, good to have you with us again. So what do you think of Mark's contention?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that you see this power shift. I think it has to do with two major factors. One is the movement from partisan primaries to the top two. During the partisan primaries, the Democrats, while the population is larger in Southern California, it was almost even in terms of registered voters within the Democratic Party. And then the second part is really the demographic shift away from the Bay Area, and even to some extent away from L.A. County. L.A. County right now is about a fifth of the state's population, but it used to be a quarter, but it was much more conservative. But you also see counties like Orange County, Riverside County, and San Bernardino County, which were much more, you know, red and even, you know, purple. They're now actually blue, and that has shifted a lot of the power down to Southern California. Remember, Southern California was Republican. We had Nixon, Reagan, Schwarzenegger, Wilson, Dukmejian. You can go on and on. And then all the Democrats were from Northern California, Boxer, Feinstein, Newsom, Harris, you know, Willie Brown, Pelosi, Burt, you can go on and on, Jerry Brown.
Yeah.
And so now you see a big shift. And that really started also with the state legislature. The last five or six speakers of the state assembly have all been from Southern California, and so have most of the president pro tems of the Senate. And so this recruitment that happened at that level is happening a lot more now in Southern California.
That's such an interesting point you raise. Yeah, you remember when the Burtons and Willie Brown and you know, all Northern California folks for years were the leaders in the state legislature, Fernando.
That's right. You know, and don't forget, you know, Leo McCarthy and people like that. And they kind of recruited people. Now, that's still happening somewhat. If you take a look at statewide offices, it's almost a lot of Northern California still dominates. You know, you have Rob Bonta, Tony Thurmond, you have Fiona Ma, Koulinakis. Almost all of them are from Northern California. And if you take a look at, believe it or not, like five people have already announced that they're running for governor. And all of them, with the exception of Tony Atkins from San Diego, are from Northern California. So there's still, it's not like Northern California is out of it. It's just a lot more even than it used to be.
And Mark, where does the funding come into this? Because, you know, Governor Gavin Newsom he was groomed for this. He had his political patrons who really, you know, funded him and guided him all along the way. Willie Brown was so well known, not just for his holding office, but the people that he really groomed for public office and mentored. So, it doesn't seem like in Southern California we have that same sort of a pipeline.
Well, there were, as you suggest, the Burton machine, Willie Brown, and others, Gavin Newsom starting out, Kamala Harris starting out as a Willie Brown protege. One advantage that candidates have had in Northern California, and to some extent continue to have, is there's a larger fundraising base to draw from. Silicon Valley up here, San Francisco. There's just more of a political infrastructure. But as we've seen, money in California is not dispositive. We could talk all day about well-funded candidates. Meg Whitman comes to mind, Bill Simon Jr., folks who have a lot of money who end up flaming out at the state level. So money helps. It's not the be-all and the end-all. But that's something else that for a long time gave Northern California candidates an advantage.
Fernando, your thoughts about that and why? I mean, you mentioned the party breakdown being a prime issue, but what about that candidate pipeline and funding apparatus?
Yeah, I think funding for campaigns has drastically changed. It used to depend on several patrons who would then be able to get to others to bring you money. Now, like Katie Porter's a great example. She gets money from all over the state and all over the country. The small donors that you use social media to raise money has really changed the dynamic of fundraising in politics, not only at the national and state level, but even at the local level. And so you don't need these very wealthy individuals to the same extent you did in the past. And so not only is, you know, social media different, fundraising is very different than it was just 10 years ago.
We're talking with Professor Fernando Guerra of Loyola Marymount University and Mark Baraback, political columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Mark, do you think that this trend towards Southern California gaining power is likely to continue?
Well, I think it depends a lot on personalities. I think that, you know, again, this is a function of familiarity, not breeding contempt, but in this case, getting people to vote for you. I mean, that was another piece of it. You know, for a long time, there was sort of this more of a cohesion, if you will, to the Bay Area. People in Northern California, the Bay Area, tended to support other folks from the Bay Area. I think that it's going to depend on the candidate, but certainly there's that opportunity to become known, as I suggested, for Katie Porter, for Adam Schiff, to get known in the Bay Area in a way that you know, previously candidates, particularly House members, couldn't get known. Again, that goes back to social media. As Fernando said, you know, you can raise money very easily on the internet. You don't need a patron. You don't need some wealthy supporter or two. You don't need that pipeline the way candidates mm-hmm. needed it in the past.
Mark, thank you as always. Great to talk with you about your recent column in the Los Angeles Times. And always, I'd like to talk with Fernando Guerra of Loyola Marymount University. Thank you, Fernando. Well, in many parts of Southern California, residents are awakened with the sounds of flocks of parrots making their way to trees in their neighborhood. Those parrots also become quite noisy and active when we get close to sunset as they return to the trees where they roost. Well, our Jacob Margolis, LA's science reporter, actually went out with an Occidental College group to try and gather more information about the wild parrots of Southern California. Jacob, good to have you with us.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk about birds.
It's great. And the parrots are, you know, people always ask who are new to the area, how did you end up with parrots? They can't be native to here. One of the things I heard years ago, Jacob, was this urban legend that there had been a pet store in the San Gabriel Valley that had a fire and that the parrots inside the store had escaped and that these are the descendants of those parrots. I think that story was debunked years ago as well. But where do we think they came from?
Well, we know that they originally came from Mexico. How they got here, when I was out with the group, heard several different stories for several different types of parrots, and people might not realize, but there are, I think, on my list, I have at least seven different kinds of parrots, parakeets, that did come up from Central America to Los Angeles and now have established themselves. And the ones that are the most common are red-crowned parrots, so the ones they just have a little crown on there, red crown, and then the lilac-crowned parrots. But I believe that the yellow, what are they called? The
yellow-headed.
Exactly. Yellow-headed parrots were here first in the 1950s or so, and then the red crown and the lilac crown came around the 70s or 80s, and really started. Their populations exploded over the past decade. So now there's a lot more.
I remember when I started working at LAS, then KPCC, this was around 1980, late 79, and I had never been exposed to the parents. They were so loud. I was so surprised. And, you know, over time, you just get kind of used to them in most cases. But but certainly their squawking can be annoying to some as well. Do animal control deal with them at all, or are they just allowed to go about their way unless they're injured?
I mean, as far as I know, they're out and about, just jumping from tree to tree. Now, what's particularly interesting about the parrots that they have established themselves here, and the reason I did this, one of the reasons I did this piece, is that actually the red crown, the lilac crown parrots come from completely different parts of Mexico on opposite sides of the country, and they are now coexisting together here, and the habitats that they are native to are also completely different than Southern California. So down in Mexico, it's a lot warmer. There's a lot more forested areas. There's a lot more food for them. I mean, natively. But here, it's colder. You know, they tend not to establish themselves out in our native landscapes. And so really what ended up happening, what it seems like, is that we over the past, I would say 100 years, have used supplemental irrigation to really inadvertently establish what is a useful habitat for them. So they tend to feast on subtropical fruits from what we can tell, like loquats come to mind. They seem to really like those. And then a lot of other fruiting trees. I actually talked about the another bird last week as well, called the swinhoe's white eye, which is just establishing itself here as well. And it was the same story. Native habitat, much different than here, but the urban landscape for some reason is like perfect for them.
We're talking to the Birdman of Pasadena, or LAist, Jacob Margolis, LAist science reporter. Yeah. Jacob, sounds like then these different species of parrots that came originally from Mexico, you know, brought by human hands, that they could be one of the species to actually benefit from climate change. And I wonder, as Southern California warms, if we might see a significant growth in their population. Is that being speculated?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm don't want to say there's any general benefit to climate change, of course. However, what it does indicate is that there is some adaptability. At least some species are able to adapt quite well. And it seems these parrots, are able to establish, they've established, I believe, in Texas and Florida, in warmer climates that don't really hit freezing as often. And so, yeah, I mean, certainly they're able to shift and survive. They're pretty smart, is what I've also been told, as we know, with, like, you know, the African gray parrots. But the truth is, so everything's going to, a lot of animals are going to be able to adapt, but there's going to be a limit to that adaptation. And so desert birds come to mind, actually, in that we're just seeing such hot temperatures out in the desert. Desert birds get a lot of their moisture and hydration from eating other animals. And now essentially the heat is outpacing their ability to hydrate enough to be able to stay alive. And so there will be limits that a lot of these animals reach.
Jacob, what are ways that the public in, you know, watching these parrots can participate in research efforts about them?
Oh, yeah, that's the other reason I did this piece and I went out, because I'm just so excited about learning about birds, and I think it's awfully fun. It's great for kids, too. So on our site, on LAist.com, I posted a bunch of areas where you're going to find the parrots, or different kinds of parrots. And what people can do is they can actually go out, and with the app iNaturalist, which, again, I linked to in the article, it's a free app. I believe it's a nonprofit, and you could take pictures of the parrots, of the birds, you upload them to the app, and then researchers, such as those at Occidental, can use that data to identify where the different birds are, what they're eating, who they're hanging out with, if they're hybridizing, which it seems like they might be once in a while. And again, like, I think that's really fun to do with kids. And there's spots all over the place, and the app is free.
If they're crossbreeding, is it possible that you could get a distinct enough offspring of that it's its own, you know, LA parrot?
I pushed this question 7,000 times when I was hanging out with the birders, and the answer was we're likely seeing some hybridization. However, to get complete like new species, it would take a very long time and be a very specific thing that they would, I guess it's a very technical thing that they have to establish. But you know what? I want to say yes. Why not? If enough birds are hybridizing, you might get a lineage that is interesting and unique enough. Maybe even if it is hundreds of years down the line.
Tim in Beverly Woods says, parrots love the pepper trees. I live in Beverly Woods. The parrots love the berries on the bloom. Tim, we have a pepper tree in our backyard, and I second your statement about that. They love it. They just
do they wake you up, Larry?
They do on weekends. Weekdays, I'm up before they are, so to get here for the show. But weekends, when I sleep later, yes, they wake me up, definitely. Tim, thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. And we should just, we have like a minute left, Jacob. Mm-hmm. Mention there are also parakeets, and do they live closer to the coast?
Yeah, you know what? There are some over in the Santa Monica Mountains. There are spots for a lot of these birds, again, on our website, laist.com, that you could go check out and go hang out with them and have a good time. They are unbelievably loud. I mean, some of the parakeets, Nande parakeets, mitered parakeets, yellow chevron parakeets, red mass parakeets, ebird.com, by the way, for everybody. Cornell runs a site. It's great.
Oh, great.
You can go check out the birds, too.
Jacob, thank you so much, as always. You get the most fun assignments going out looking at parrots. And
I have the best job ever.
You do. You really do. And I'm so glad you share it with us, because then we can live through you vicariously. So thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
Jacob Margolis, LA's science reporter, joining us on Air Talk. As he said, you can see his piece at LA's.com, in which he lays out what it was like going out with the folks from Occidental College to take a look at the parrots of Los Angeles.
The LA's Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Well, Friday, huge news from the world of residential real estate. Powerful real estate trade group has agreed to do away with its policies for buyer's commissions that for decades help set those commission. This effort is to resolve lawsuits that claim that the rules have forced people to pay artificially inflated costs to buy homes. We'll talk about the terms of the agreement with Wall Street Journal National Legal Affairs reporter Laura Casisto. Laura, thank you so much for joining us. So what has the National Association of Realtors agreed to do?
So they've agreed to do two key things. The first thing that they have agreed to do is they've agreed to take real estate compensation for real estate agent commissions out of listings. And so it means that I, as a seller, when I go to sell my home, I no longer have that conversation with my agent where I say, let's put a 2.5% commission in the listing. The second thing that they've agreed to do is make it mandatory for buyers to sign agreements with their own agents. And so what this also does is this forces buyers agents to have a conversation now with their client and say, what are you going to pay me? If the seller doesn't agree to pay this, what are you willing to pay me for my services?
And does that mean you could go to a retainer with a buyer's real estate agent, you know, someone, okay, pay you X amount of money to take us to such and such homes, or, you know, for in terms of the practical impact of this, what is expected?
Yeah, so I think we're going to see, I mean, right now, you know, I follow a lot of real estate agents on Twitter and you know, belong to their Facebook groups. And I think everyone's really kind of brainstorming, what does this new world look like? But I think what we know, what the sort of key points that we understand are, one, you know, that sellers are no longer going to be the ones, at least sort of publicly, to set the compensation for buyer's agents. And two, that buyer's agents are going to have some hard conversations with their clients. They're no longer going to be able to rely on the seller seller to necessarily cover that commission. The seller might choose to do so, but they're going to have a tough conversation with their client kind of right from the beginning, where they say, hey, like, what are you willing to pay me? What is this service work for you? And I think we could see a few different things come from that. We could see potentially hourly rates evolve from that. We could see fee for service. Mm-hmm. We could see commissions come down. And I think we could also see buyers say, you know, I'm not going to use an agent at all. I want to save this money. I don't want to have to worry about paying for it.
We're talking with Laura Casisto, who is National Legal Affairs Reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Also with us from UC Irvine, Professor of Economics and Director of UCI's Center for Real Estate. State, Ed Colson. Ed, thank you for being with us. Is this going to affect what people pay for an agent to sell their homes?
Well, I think so, because the 6% commission always covered the buyer's agent, the buyer's broker, the seller's agent's broker. And so there's not as much need to pay the buyer's agent, so you would think that that would get cut out of the total commission that sellers would have to pay. We'll see lowering of total fees.
And what does this mean for the compensation of realtors then? Because in Southern California, you've got people in residential real estate who handle a lot of properties, make a very comfortable living doing so. Is this going to put real estate agents' jobs and livelihoods into serious jeopardy?
Well, we'll see. The thing to remember is that there was always a split. That 6% or 5%, whatever the standard commission was, that was always split between buyers' agents and brokers and sellers' agents and brokers. And now there's not the requirement that the buyer's agent and broker be compensated. And so if you lower the commission from, say, 6% to 3%, that would just cover what was always covered for the sellers.
So they'd make the same amount of money. Yeah.
Well, maybe. I mean, one of the things I think is coming out of this is that people now recognize in a way that they might not have before that these commission rates were always negotiable. This was never a law. This was never a regulation. It was always negotiable. It just never was. And so now that this lawsuit has developed through the courts, now people recognize that it's much more negotiable than maybe they realized before. So who knows what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wonder, does this potentially, Professor, make the fights over listing of properties, which are already hot in areas with limited inventory, even more intense? Because, being the listing agent is going to be the much bigger deal than being an agent for buyers.
Right. So, yeah. So more of your business has got to come from being the seller side. I think that was, as you say, kind of always the case. And maybe that's going to be intensified somewhat.
All right. We're talking with Ed Colson of UC Irvine, where he's director of the Center for Real Estate. He's professor of economics. And Laura Casisto is national legal affairs reporter for The Wall Street Journal. I'd love to hear from any AirTalk listeners who work in residential real estate your thoughts about how this is going to affect your livelihood and the way in which residential real estate is sold. We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Laura, I was reading that this could have a negative effect on first-time homebuyers, people who might already be challenged in coming up with the down payment for a home. How might this make it tougher for them?
So I think, so what we don't quite know yet, because this is such a big upheaval, is are first-time buyers still going to be able to finance this? Because, of course, what happened when the seller was covering the full commission, the seller was able to sort of finance it from the proceeds of the home. And so the question is now, will mortgage lenders allow buyers to roll this into the cost of buying a home? There are people who think that they will, but if they can't, this is a real challenge for them, right? Because they're already cash-strapped, and this means that you're having to come up with $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 commission also on top of that. And that's something that's, I think, going to be a big challenge for people who are already coming to the closing table, kind of barely making that down payment work.
And again, so it sounds like what a buyer's agent would need to do fairly early in the process with a prospective buyer is to sign a contract with them, an agreement for what they would be compensated for the services provided to the buyer. Is that what this is going to mean in practice?
Yeah, for sure. Now, I mean, I think that there, I mean, it is a requirement that a buyer's agent have that conversation with their client right off the bat. And it may be, you know, they say, okay, my fee is going to be 1.5% of the sale. Say that's what they agree to. It may be that they then call the seller's agent and the seller says, yeah, I'll cover that. That could happen. But the buyer is going to have to understand from the beginning that if the seller doesn't agree to that, the buyer is on the hook. And that is like a sort of big, big shift in the way this works. Buyers, you know, I got tons of emails from people on Friday saying, what are you talking about? Buyer's agents were free. I think that's how buyers thought about it.
Sure,
they never
wrote
that check.
Yeah, I always thought of it as that way because in practice it kind of was.
Exactly.
But this,
so I don't think you're going to have people thinking that anymore.
No, definitely not. It's going to be. And the other thing, if you've got a period like we have right now where inventory is very low, you know, you're going to have a really motivated seller who's going to be willing to pick up the buyer's commission, right?
I think that's right. Absolutely. I think that in a hot market, it's going to be harder to convince a seller to pay that cost, to have that incentive. You know, I think this is going to depend a lot on market dynamics. Although a kind of interesting question is, though, if the cost of selling a home is now lower for a seller, right, if it's 3% instead of 6%, are they going to be more willing to put their home on the market? Do we see this help with inventory a little bit because you don't need as much equity to kind of cover the cost of selling a home? That's, I think, one possible theory of how this plays out, that it's good for the housing market.
Professor, is it possible that this becomes baked into a lower asking price?
Right. I think that's one of the great unexplored aspects of this is how is this going to affect the dynamics between buyers and sellers? We know one thing, which is that because the commission rate is going to be lower, both buyers and sellers are going to benefit. Buyers are going to pay lower prices. Sellers are going to get slightly higher prices net of commission than they were before, just because the gap between the buyer price, if you will, and the seller price, the difference of which is the commission, is going to be narrower than it was before. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for walking us through this. An earth-shaking announcement Friday that this agreement has been reached between the National Association of Realtors and those who had filed lawsuits against the organization, claiming that the industry had conspired to keep agent commissions high. Joining us, Laura Casisto of the Wall Street Journal, Ed Colson of UC Irvine, where he's professor and director of UCI's Center for Real Estate.
I feel in the Hispanic communities, we're just told to kind of just keep going. Don't feel.
I'm LAist mental health reporter Robert Garova. Getting mental health care is often overwhelming.
If you have a patient that was admitted for a serious suicide attempt, if they haven't been suicidal for 24 hours, the insurance company is like, get them hell out.
My reporting helps unravel the knot by focusing on the stories of people struggling to make the mental health care system work for them.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
Now with us is our Sharon McNary, who ran her 163rd marathon yesterday in the LA Marathon. Sharon, thank you for joining us. Congratulations. This is an incredible mark that you've reached.
Well, thank you, and happy Medal Monday to all my fellow marathoners out there. There were 20,000 finishers yesterday of 26,000 people registered, so maybe a tough day for a lot of people.
Yeah. What is it like? I mean, does this ever get old for you, given what a veteran you are in these runs?
I will tell you, it gets old between miles 18 and 23. Because at mile 18, you're passing by the finish line and you look across the street and you see all these happy people running into the finish and you've still got 8 miles to go. And you say, why do I keep signing up for these things? You know, you hate being so tired and you just want to walk, but it's going to take longer if I walk. So it does get old, but you know, it's I guess it's like having kids. People tell me the pain goes away and then you just want to do another one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd love to hear from listeners who ran the LA Marathon yesterday. We're at 866-893-5722 or email us at LAist.com. And let us know what you thought about it. So please share your thoughts about it. Sharon, for you, I wonder about the LA Marathon versus all the others. I mean, you competed all over the place, internationally. So how does LA stack up as a marathon?
LA is not a world-class marathon. It was coming close to it when the course went from Dodger Stadium to the ocean, and it went past all these landmarks, and it had a downhill and a flat finish. That was pretty epic, and that to me was a very attractive marathon to an international audience. The prize money's never been top level like you'd see in Chicago or New York, so it's been mostly over the years primarily a really good regional marathon, fairly well organized. There's always some quirks, you know, with getting to the starting line and all the logistics. And, you know, this marathon has had probably 8 or 9 different courses since I started running it back in 1991. So, but it's a solid marathon. You'll have a good experience coming here. What they had to do is after the pandemic, Santa Monica did no longer participate as one of the cities along the marathon route. So it turns around at the Veterans Administration or down on San Vicente, makes a U-turn and goes back up the hill to Century City. And that was a little demoralizing for some people. But I just want to add this. There's so many kids in the race. And of course, their entire families come out to cheer them on. So that's what you saw in the final 3 miles. Very, very big crowds waiting for their kids to be finishing in the 5th and 6th and even 7th hour of this race.
I love it. Well, let's see if we can encourage Santa Monica to get back into the marathon business, because as you say, it makes so much sense to have it all be downhill, essentially, or mostly downhill to the ocean.
Well, plus it works so much better with the transit because you've got a transit connection very near the Santa Monica Pier that takes people all the way back downtown. So, you know, at Century City, you'd have to get on a bus. And like, who knows if the buses are running regularly with so many street closures. You'd have to really brainiac it out to figure out your transit access back downtown. And, you know, the parking. You wanted to go to Century City at 3 a.m. and pay $33 to park all day and then get on a shuttle and go into downtown just to get to the marathon. It's just a logistical nightmare. Yeah. Santa Monica is a lot easier if you like to use public transit, as I do whenever possible.
So there's a group of people who have run the marathon every single year. How many people have done that?
Yes, I think that there were 95 legacy runners left, most of them men, but some of them women, and they are now in their 60s and 70s, and I think the oldest one was 85, and I saw a good number of them. I think my favorite was a guy named Luis. He's run every single one until this year, and he didn't want to break his streak, and so I saw him using a wheelchair.
Wow. Great for him.
Yeah. And he's
terrific.
I think he was 79, going to turn 80. Yeah.
Oh, that's
great. People aren't messing around. I mean, I would never want to have that monkey on my back. I try never to streak marathons because
more pressure than you need.
It's a lot of pressure, you know, knowing you got to come back and do the same course every year. But a couple of them, you know, like Lou Briones, he's a guy who actually got into Kona on the Ironman. So really top level athlete. I saw a woman there, May. She's, I think, 69. Most of them are pretty much walking with a little bit of jogging at this point. But I passed a good number of them, and I always said hi. They wear a bib on their back that says Legacy May or Legacy Jane.
I want to ask you,
it's a very inspiring group.
About on the opposite end of the spectrum, the young people who actually go through a special training program available to them when we come back from a call. But Christina in Koreatown, good to have you with us. So what's your experience been running the LA Marathon?
Well, I walked it, and congratulations, Auntie Sharon, for doing your 160th. I sort of signed up last minute, and I figured I'd sort of train and do it at the same time. It took 8.5 hours. I will say there were no bananas nor porta potties when we got to the finish. And
is this Christina Wong?
It absolutely is, Auntie Sharon.
Oh my God.
Auntie Sharon scolds me for not doing real training, but listen, I'm a busy lady. So it's and then there's no bathroom and no entertainment when you are a walker, right? And I had to go to Whole Foods in Brentwood, use their facilities.
I'm sure it was very nice, the Whole Food in Brentwood.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, if you are going to use a restroom along the route, let it be the Whole Foods in Brentwood.
Yeah.
They don't bother you at all. And what else can I say? At 3 o'clock, they push you onto the sidewalk. So I'm wearing my like marathon number, and there's a guy in a full oxygen tank and fireman costume faster than me. So I'm wearing a teddy bear costume faster than me. It's a little demoralizing, but
a great story to tell, Christina. Hey, Christina, thanks so much. Appreciate it. And we'd love to hear from other listeners who have run the L.A. Marathon what you particularly appreciate about it. 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. Sharon, tell us about the Students Run L.A. nonprofit, please.
Oh, sure. And by the way, that was Christina Wong, Pulitzer Prize finalist for drama and author of the Sweatshop Overlord play.
Funny. I loved her. Great storyteller. You could tell just from her call. Yes.
Yeah. But I disapprove of attention runners on the most part. Anyway, so Students Run LA, this year they had 3,200 kids in the race. They start training in September. Normally you can't register for the LA Marathon unless you're 16 years or older, but they have kids as young as middle school, 12 and 13 year olds, training from September through March to run the marathon. And the way they do this is they've got small squads of coaches, you know, doing after school training. And then 6 times in the year leading up to the marathon, they all go to a 5K and then a 10K and then a half marathon. And then they do the 18-mile friendship run out at Hanson Dam. And if they make that, then they go to the marathon. So jumping from 18 miles to 26 is still a pretty big jump. I prefer to do at least 20 miles myself, and I used to actually do 30 in training. But, you know, these are kids. Their joints are still young. Yeah. They haven't ruined themselves yet with too much running. And they run with batches of coaches. And so one thing that I saw was a friend of mine who's one of these coaches, her faster runners had gone on ahead, but she stayed behind with 3 kids who were too young to do the course by themselves. And if she hadn't stayed with them, they'd have gotten picked up and taken off the course because they were falling behind. But they all finished.
Wow.
It's a great group.
That's terrific. Sharon, you know, you're a heroic figure to so many of us. You're
gifted.
Doesn't
feel like that at mile 18.
I'm sure it doesn't. I don't know how far that goes when you're in the middle of the race. But not only are you a gifted host and reporter, but also athlete. You're the real deal. Thanks, Sharon McNary of LAist, joining us on Air Talk in yesterday's LA Marathon.
The journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm LAist correspondent Josie Huang.
LA's Chinatown is a neighborhood in flux.
I tell the stories of recent Asian American immigrants and families who've been here for generations.
I can never forget where I come from.
How they navigate being Asian and American.
But her landlord has ordered the tenants, mostly Asian immigrants, to move out so she can renovate the property.
And how that shapes LA's future.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us, and I appreciate your financial support. I also want to congratulate two other Southern California women's teams in the tournament. When I was talking about this powerhouse, USC and UCLA women, also UC Irvine and Cal Baptist in Riverside also made March Madness in the tournament out of Southern California. So 4 women's teams and 2 men's teams that have made it to March Madness. We turn our attention now to a promising medication for treating those with food allergies. The drug is one that's been available for those who have asthma. It's called Xolair. That's the brand name of the drug. And under this new FDA approval, patients as young as age one who have food allergies can take an injection of the drug every 2 to 4 weeks to help protect them against having a severe reaction to the food to which they're allergic. Joining us is Dr. Tina Sinder, who is Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at Stanford University. She's an immunologist and pediatric specialist. Dr. Sinder, thank you very much for being with us.
And thank you so much for having me.
So share with us how it was detected that Xolair being used for patients with asthma might have a protective effect with food allergies.
Yeah, so some of that has been based on studies that have now been ongoing for years, phase one, phase two studies that basically looked at, you know, how Xolair works, which is that it attaches to your allergic cells, your IgE cells, and takes it out of circulation. So because a lot of, you know, as we know it, IgE-mediated food allergy is driven by those cells, the thought was, perhaps Xolair can be used for that. So that's how the initial study started and led to the phase three trial that is ongoing right now that led to the FDA approval. So very exciting times.
It sounds like it. Now, the only other FDA-approved treatment I know is Palforzia, and that is an oral immunotherapy. How does that work versus Xolair?
Yes, that's a great question. So the way that oral immunotherapy works is that you take incremental amounts, small amounts of the allergen that you're trying to treat. So Palforzia is specific for peanut allergy, and you start with low dose of daily peanut ingestion until you get up to the equivalent of about a peanut every day. And that is, Palforzia, as I mentioned, is only for peanuts. And OIT, of course, off-label can be used for any allergens and is used in many clinics, but not all. The way Xolair works is that it is approved, as you mentioned, from age one and above, and it is not specific to an allergen. So it really can be very helpful for those who have multi-food allergies. And in our population, we see that in children, up to 45% of them are not just allergic to one food, but many foods.
Is there any concern that in Xolair being used to sort of you keep the immune system from kicking into overdrive with these specific food items, that it could suppress the immune system in other ways? Or is it so highly targeted that's not a risk?
Oh, that's a great question. In pediatrics, that's something that has been looked at extensively. So Xolair has been in the market now for over 20 years. So it is not a new drug. It's been out there. We have lots of post-marketing data. And although there is some theoretical risk for helminthic infections, so parasites and things like that, because IgE can help fight off those kind of infections, but really it has not in our understanding, we have not seen an impact in reducing an immune response to the most commonly seen bacterial, viral infections or vaccine responses. So immunodeficiency is not something we worry about with Xolair on board.
With the patients in the clinical trial, to what degree did we see Xolair being effective against an anaphylactic reaction to a food?
Oh, yes. So the way that patient participants were included in the study is that they had to react to less than a third of a peanut. So 100 milligrams of peanut protein they were reactive to. And then after 16 to 20 weeks of injections, either every 2 weeks or once a month, they were able to tolerate 67% of the participants were able to tolerate up to 2.5 peanuts without dose-limiting symptoms, without anaphylaxis.
Can this be self-administered, or does it have to be done in a doctor's office?
So the first three doses of Xolair has to be administered in a doctor's office, and that's because it does come with the black box warning of anaphylaxis. That being said, our food allergy patients who have food allergy and have been through anaphylaxis, that has been a risk they are aware of. In post-marketing data, the risk is only 0.2% of patients who have anaphylaxis. Even so, we recommend the first three doses in the doctor's office where they are equipped to manage allergic reactions. However, beyond that point, it is approved for home use, and patients can be trained while in clinic, and they can do so at home if they would prefer that.
Dr. Sender, one of the things that I've been reading about this, and you just sort of indicated those in the clinical trial were highly reactive to even small quantities of the allergens, but that for those that are so highly reactive, they might not even be able to eat in restaurants at all because of accidental exposure to exactly. whatever the food allergen is. Would this give those young people and their parents enough confidence that maybe they could go out to, they still have to avoid, obviously, the allergens. This does not mean that if you have a peanut allergy, you should eat peanuts. But does this provide consistent enough protection that those that maybe have avoided eating in not totally controlled environments could do so in restaurants?
Yes, that's that is such an important element of food allergy. It's the quality of life, right? Like all the things you are giving up because you are trying to manage food allergy and avoid reactions. So we are hopeful that having a drug like this available can open up the life for a lot of our food allergic patients and their families and make it safer for them to live life and participate in social activities. I did want to point out that the study still shows 67% were, had a positive benefit. That still shows that one third did not. So mm-hmm. there's still a lot more that needs to be done and studied, and we're still looking into this, but it's still a very exciting step in a positive direction.
And I would assume that even with this, the patients would still need to carry an EpiPen, right? So that epinephrine is available if they do have that reaction?
Exactly. And something we're always telling our families is that this is not a cure. We have not quite gotten to that point yet. So we still have to do all the things you did before. Carry your EpiPen, practice food avoidance, be mindful of food in your environment. So all those things still are in play, but we are hopeful that this is a step where our patients with history of severe allergic reactions, multiple food allergy, at high risk for coming across accidental food exposures will be better protected so they don't have reactions when they're accidentally exposed.
Robin in Leimert Park called to say, Xolair has changed my life. I had to fight with my insurance company to get it. I'm allergic to a lot of everyday fruits, so this has really allowed me to function. Robin, thank you so much for sharing that. Dr. Sender, thank you for being with us this morning on Air Talk.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Tina Sender, Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine, Pediatrics, Allergy, and Immunology at Stanford University, and an investigator on the ongoing study looking at the effectiveness of Xolair on severe food allergy reaction.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiots and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.